Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And is this our ninth year we're entering?
Entering. We're not there yet. We're still in December, right? We must remember, of course. Today, we have to remind you that it's time for you to make your New Year's resolutions, because we're wishing you a Happy New Year, and we're hoping that you're going to do something bold and something good for yourself in this upcoming year of 2013. And in the meantime, this is an interesting program for Peter. Peter, this is one of those programs where Peter hardly gets a word in edgeways, because it's mostly ladies in the kitchen in today's program. We have a couple of guys who crept in with a few words, and I guess I crept in with even fewer words.
Is that true? You listened to it after the
interview. Yeah, of course I did. Of course I did. But as I said, we have a couple of guys who managed to sneak in there, representing either their better halves or their owners. But it's mostly about the role of women in the kitchen. And to finish it off, I think you'll understand the theme even more when you hear what Charlotte Druckmann had to say with a book with 229 what do they call it? Footnotes.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're looking for footnotes, save yourself till the end. In the meantime, starting out, a chef who had early huge success in New York City, even though she's from the Deep South, and for her first cookbook written in collaboration with her husband, what's her first name?
Allison Vines Rushing. Slade Rushing, her husband.
But they chose the name of their cookbook to be Southern Comfort.
Yeah.
One of the most fun aspects of this book, Southern Comfort, is the little stories that the authors, chefs, both of them, Allison Vines Rushing and Slade Rushing, the little stories, they're just so down to earth and funny. But how unlikely is this whole scenario of the two of you meeting over a hot stove in a restaurant and ending up with your own restaurant in New Orleans, married, just an 8-month-old, I think you said, baby, and your own. And let's not forget the little drama of your moving back to New Orleans just before Katrina hit. This is a scenario you wouldn't make work in a movie, would it?
Well,
that's like,
no, it definitely does have a Hollywood script to it sometimes. It depends on who's looking at it, I guess. The culinary world throws things at you sometimes. Sometimes Cupid's arrow, sometimes Hurricane Katrina. It's an exciting lifestyle. It can take you anywhere. So a lot of times chefs tend to go back to the place where they feel the inspiration from. New Orleans is such a great city.
Oh, I love it.
It's full of wonderful music. It's full of an artistic feel. It's got a great energy when there's no storms coming through, I should say. But we love it.
And your restaurant there is now called Mila?
That's right. Mila has been open for, it'll be 7 years.
Oh, shoot.
Really? No, I'm sorry. Five years.
Yeah.
5 years, my bad. It actually was 5 years this month, in November. So I can't believe how fast time has flown.
And this is your first cookbook, which I find hard.
Well, it takes time to write a good book. It takes time to have good content. And I think Alice and I, we had an opportunity to come up with a book back in 2004. And we were still wet behind the ears in the chefdom world. We had just taken over as chefs for our first time, and things were happening pretty quickly. Allison just won her James Beard Award, and we didn't feel like it was right. And it takes time to kind of learn your style of food through the years and to see what really works. It's kind of a Polaroid picture. You shake back and forth. It takes time for the picture to come to life.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I always question the regulations around the Rising Star Chef Award. I mean, how many people under 30 really have found their style of cooking? Not that many.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably
now,
not
you
that
did.
Many.
Did you?
Well, we kind of made the cuisine that, well, it is definitely one that stuck with us, and it's who we were. We met in New Orleans, and we've always loved this area. We're back here, and so, yeah, I guess we had found it, but it's a surprise. Yeah, it's a surprise we still do it, and that, yeah, that it's worked
you
out.
You have some of the same
time.
Dishes, actually. You have,
we do.
Yeah, I mean, tell us, we might as well get this out of the way. Right off the bat, let's talk about the deconstructed oysters Rockefeller, because I've never read anything about you that did not mention this recipe, and it's in this book.
Yeah, it's a great dish. It's definitely one that will be with us until we are no longer. It's one of our greatest hits, for sure.
And what is it exactly?
Well, we poach the oysters. We take the oysters out of the shell. We poach them in beurre fondue, an emulsified butter sauce with a little acidity from a lemon. And then we serve the poached oysters on brown butter spinach. We top them with bacon chips and grated licorice root.
Now, where did you get this idea for the grated licorice root? I haven't had that except in Italy over, it was saffron risotto.
Well, I gotta say, working in New York City is one of the most challenging environments of kitchen speaking, that is. Things happen very quickly, it's always busy, and it's, to me, it's where the best chefs in the world collaborate and they do their best work. You have to sacrifice family holiday gatherings, and you don't see your family for a while, but if you can go up there and hang out for a while, you'll see things you've never seen before. And licorice root was one of the many things we saw, and ingredients. I can't tell you enough of the lessons and cooking in general we learned, but licorice, there was a lot of chefs use it with, they use it with game, pigeon. Chef I worked with at Fleur de Sel used it, and he did it with mushrooms a lot, and it just has like a unique, it's licorice, but it's very subtle. It kind of numbs your palate a little bit, but it also, it's just something very, it's kind of mystical when you taste it. It kind of, it's like, what is that in that dish? I like it, but what is it? The Oysters Rockefeller had, traditionally it has, herb saint, anise, some sort of anise liqueur in there. And this was our kind of our fresh little take. It was kind of like a whisper of anise without having to overwhelm it. Like you can get that sense of overwhelmment when you have that liqueur in an Oysters Rockefeller sometimes.
So sometimes it can be too much. Right? Now here, if you want a piece of ultimate trivia about licorice root, there's a very famous lady who likes licorice root, especially licorice root from Tropea, in Calabria, in Italy, and her name is Queen Elizabeth II. This is one of the things she absolutely adores, and I guess she can afford to have it shipped in probably any time she likes.
A lot of people, when they see it says grated licorice root on the menu here at Mila with the dish, they question it, because a lot of people aren't licorice fans, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not a crazy licorice fan either, but when you have it this method, and it's so light and so gentle that you can't help but enjoy it on the dish. It's just, people think black licorice, you know, which is very strong and aggressive. This is very gentle, and it really goes nice with those fresh poached oysters, the butter poached oysters, and the brown butter spinach with the shallots. And
you're making me so hungry.
Let's go to another dish that you've obviously perfected, been working on for a long time, that isn't necessarily one of people's favorites, and that's okra. We were talking about the way you cook okra before we came on the air. Tell our listeners about that.
I love okra, and okra is just a southern vegetable. A lot of people around the rest of the U.S. might not quite get it, mainly because it can have a really slimy texture. Definitely a unique kind of mouthfeel to okra. And a lot of times that's why people really enjoy it fried. Down here, mostly people fry it, because that takes away kind of sliminess of it. It's wonderful when it's super crispy. We love to do southern vegetables, but in a little lighter way, and we try not to rely on our fryer all the time. So this was kind of, doing okra this way, it was kind of Indian inspired. There's lots of great Indian okra recipes for crispy okra and julienne crispy okra, stuff like that. So we mainly just make an oil, a chili oil with a little crushed red pepper, and then we drizzle that on top of the okra and cook it at real high heat in the oven until it's kind of brown all over, roasted and crispy, and it's delicious to die for.
Now you have another trick too, though, which is cooking it beside lamb when you're cooking lamb.
We do. We had a Creole spiced lamb that we did at the restaurant and coat the outside of the lamb really nice in Creole spice. It was lamb loin and sear it. And then the fat that rendered out of the lamb that was left in the pan, we would use that to cook the okra on the stovetop until it got nice and roasted and crispy in the pan. And that's also amazing. It had a little of that spice still left over and that delicious kind of musky lamb fat. So, yeah, really
Well, you know, you're steering us back to where we probably should have started, and that is the concept of this book. It's titled Southern Comfort, but then you say it's a new take on the recipes we grew up with. Now, both of you are from the South. Allison, you're from Mississippi?
I'm from Louisiana.
She was from Mississippi. And Slade is from Mississippi.
That's right.
Okay, which is why your restaurant is called M-I-L-A, right?
That's right.
Okay, now, so you grew up with Southern comfort food, which you indicated there's a lot of frying going on, a lot of fat, and sometimes a lot of heavy. Tell me what your concept of this book was. Was it to lighten some of these or make them more surprising, or what was the concept?
Well, I'll tell you, the it's not a bad thing by any means. We love good soul food, good Southern cooking. We love it as is. But when you pour a nice glass of red wine at the dinner table, it's nice to sometimes step back from all that richness and kind of enhance the flavors you're with. Maybe bring in an element from another country. For instance, like the smoked pepper seared tuna, which is in the book. It's almost like you've got the flavor of a seared tuna with a light smokiness. Like you feel like you're at a barbecue joint eating tuna, in a sense. But we do molasses and soy reduction. So molasses soy syrup that we bring down nice and slow. That soy actually adds a nice little saltiness and kind of an umami type flavor, a richness to that molasses, and it goes great with that tuna. But there's another dish. It's like the buttered cabbage with we do it with snapper here at the restaurant. Cabbage is so typically cooked down with bacon, and it's delicious, but you kind of don't understand the beauty of cabbage, what it tastes like. In the book, we have a simple recipe where we simply cut the cabbage down into manageable pieces, and we blanch it in salted water. And we always blanch our vegetables in water that's almost like seawater to enhance that flavor and to retain that color. Well, we take that cabbage and we make a beurre fondue, which is basically emulsified butter. We're basically bringing butter to a liquid state. We just glaze it in that butter with a little bit of a little dose of fresh chives, and it's so simple. It's wonderful, and it can go with just about anything from pork to you can have it with the gnocchi. We have a gnocchi recipe in there, a nice potato gnocchi.
I saw that one already. I saw that one. That jumped out at me, called my name.
We try to refine some of the recipes because the flavor's already there. Where we grew up, the flavors are all there. Sometimes less is more. If you can step back, and a lot of times we basically try to hopefully influence people with some techniques maybe they've not done before, just kind of to refine some things, and hopefully we can inspire them to come up with their own sort of ideas with Southern staples.
One of the things that amused me the most was the King Ranch chicken, which is sort of like a chicken casserole, and you said was it Allison's parents were getting divorced or your parents were getting divorced?
Oh, that's Allison's, Allison's side.
So Allison's father apparently called, he's about to be ex-wife, and said, please give me the recipe for the chicken.
Yes. Hilarious.
It sounds like something that would happen on The Good Wife, which I was reminded of because I was watching it last night, and the two mother-in-laws who hated each other were both in the kitchen at Thanksgiving on the program. I thought that was funny.
I wanted to say that even though you have new takes, fresh takes on a lot of recipes, people who buy that, who are in love with Southern cuisine and buy this book, are going to be happy to find things that are not left out, like your buttermilk fried chicken.
Yeah, it's a great recipe. I promise you it'll be one of the best you've ever had if you put the work into it. It takes a little bit of brining and some basic chicken butchery skills, but you soak it in the brine and get your oil, fresh oil, give it a nice little dusting of flour. To me, it's one of the best fried chickens I've ever had, because the flavor goes all the way down to the bone since it's in the brine. But there's so many good, you know, it's hard to, when you say fried chicken in the South, everybody knows someone has got one better than the other. It's a tough
stuff. But every Southern cookbook stuff kind of has to have a fried chicken recipe.
Of course they do. And I'm guessing that on any given day you might find Southern fried chicken on the menu at Mila.
Well, we don't have it on the menu at Mila, but you'll find...
Oh, okay, all right.
We have a fried rabbit we do at lunch we kind of give it kind of a similar techniques to the chicken. We do a rabbit loins. We crispy them up, nice little oil, and serve it with right now baby bok choy. what you see in the book. We have a recipe for baby bok choy. And
you have a lot of good vegetable recipes, but you both come from farming families, right?
Well, my dad used to have a garden all the time when I was a kid, and one of the best things was watching things grow. I think kids, it just sticks with them when you see vegetables get bigger and bigger and greener, and you kind of feel the season. Now, we don't have much seasons down here in the South, but a fall garden is it's kind of fun to be a part of. My dad let me kind of get involved with it. You don't want to be too much a part of it because that's work, but as a kid.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that concept. I have finally abandoned my garden for the fall because it arrives a little bit earlier here and nothing's growing anymore except we're hoping that the Jerusalem artichokes are still snug in the ground.
I still have some of this pit.
I have to see if I can dig some up.
And fennel, we saw fennel.
But let's not forget, listeners, the name of the cookbook is Southern Comfort.
And it's Allison Vines Rushing, hyphenated, and Slade Rushing. And their restaurant in New Orleans is Mila.
It's called Mila.
And you have to go there if you're in New Orleans. And you should get this Southern Comfort cookbook with its updated dishes. All the Southern Comfort, but with a new, more creative, modern. And you guys are doing well. How's your daughter?
Oh, she's great. Well, she's 8 months old. And, well, next week she'll be 8 months. And we started her solid food as soon as her eyes followed our food into our mouth. We started feeding her. So she started eating solid food at 4 months. And we are happy to say she has a wonderful palate.
Now, this is great. Did you ever read the book called Hungry Monkey?
I have not. No.
Oh, you should read that. It's hysterical about this guy who's the chef who's trying to develop the palate of his little girl. It's really funny. They change every week, you know. Anyhow, I wish you continuing success with your restaurant and can't wait to try some of your recipes. So success also with this book. And what else can I say? It's good talking to you again.
We've certainly enjoyed it. Thank you for having us.
Have fun, you two.
And we'll be back with another similar story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, listeners, welcome back, and I got permission. I got an official permission that I was allowed to introduce the next guest, who's a very interesting lady. And
Caroline Fidanza,
who decided after years of cooking high style modern cuisine, decided that what she really wanted to do was do something much more down market. So she and a group of friends working for her opened a wonderful little sandwich, salad, and soup shop
and a bakery
too called Salty.
I'm not altogether sure, Caroline Fidanza, if I totally understand the Salty concept and story. I must say, by the way, the writing in this book, the introduction, is brilliant writing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, but again, as I said, I'm not sure, for example, how this fascination with Herman Melville happened, which I guess is where you start in terms of that and your location. And getting the name Salty, right?
Right.
Moby Dick.
Yeah, I know. That's a tricky one, and I do, now that this book is out in the world and people are asking questions, I have a little bit of regret for ever having brought it up, because it's one of those things, and I think I allude to it a little bit in the intro, that just it was in the atmosphere, it was on our minds, and it's not a literal, I mean, it's an inspiration, but it's, you know, there's nothing literally that ties Moby Dick to this location and the food we do. It was just kind of where we were at the time. We were reading this book, we were thinking about the story, we were conceptualizing this restaurant, and it became just part of our language, because the language of that book is, it's interesting, and there are so many words that you learn, nautical terms that come up from reading the book that are curious and fun, and so then it sort of made us move more into researching nautical terms to use to name things in the restaurant, to name the restaurant. So it was just kind of a way of latching onto an idea. I feel like it sort of seems like naming your band. What are you going to call your restaurant, and how are you going to conceptualize it? So there's not a direct line from Moby Dick to Salty, other than it was just where we were at the time. It was sort of what we were reading and thinking about, and that somehow influenced some of the decisions we made at that time. And now it's just kind of fun, and it has a little bit of kitschy quality. But
so it's certainly a well-known, I can almost say iconic restaurant at this point, as many of the establishments in Boone have become. It's called Salty, a Cookbook, and you write it with others, and Don Rebecca Cullerton and Elizabeth Shula.
Yes.
And are they partners?
Yes. So Elizabeth and Rebecca are my business partners, and Anna Dunn is my longtime writing partner. Anna and I work together on a publication called The Diner Journal. So she and I...
Yes, I wanted to bring that up, too.
Yeah.
As if we weren't complicated enough. Tell me about The Diner Journal.
Well, The Diner Journal came out of The Diner and Marlowe and Sons are the two restaurants that I worked at before Salty, so that was my beginning of working in Williamsburg, was opening The Diner with Andrew Tarlow and Mark Firth in 1998.
Has it been that long ago?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
98, 99, sort of that end of 98, beginning of 99 when Diner opened. And so we opened Diner, we opened Marlowe and Sons, and there was this moment of wanting to write a cookbook. I really wanted to write a cookbook. Andrew was less interested in writing something and taking it to a publisher. He wanted to do something that he could have control over and that we could do in-house, which is definitely his style. So we decided to just do a quarterly food journal, which would be sort of like a cookbook in installments, was the original thinking about it. And at the time, Anna was working as a barista for Marlowe and Sons, and so we brought on all of the writers in the group who were waitresses or cooks or baristas or whatever they were to participate in the Diner Journal, and Anna became sort of the editor of the journal. And Anna's a very good writer in her own right, but she's also very good at being a coach and helping writers write better. So I've always had a really good writing relationship with her, and it's a lot of fun, and she's a good editor. She's just figured out how to do it on her own. She doesn't have any professional experience doing it, but I think she's a really good sort of writer's writer.
Yeah, well, that's probably because I'm a writer, and I thought so, too.
I think
that you've got a lot of talent involved in this project.
Well, hold on just a second. Does this journal still exist?
Yep, it's ongoing, yeah.
And how do people get it?
It's a subscription-based journal, so they don't take advertising. You can just go to Diner Journal, Google it, or dinerjournal.com, and you can subscribe.
Okay, great.
Or you can buy it in some bookstores. In New York, you can definitely get it. Outside of New York, I'm not exactly sure where they sold.
Well, let's go back to this restaurant. There's some discussion as to, is this a sandwich shop, or is it bigger than a sandwich shop? Or I don't know what's wrong with saying it's a sandwich shop, actually. What is the concept for Salty?
Well, it's definitely a sandwich shop, and in the beginning, we inherited the space from a woman who had a bakery. So I think in our minds, we thought it needed to be a bakery because it was. But as myself and my two partners spent some time there, we realized, yes, we want to do baked goods. Elizabeth is an excellent baker, so she could bring that to what we do. But we are all cooks, so we were much more interested in doing savory food. And given the size of the space, the only thing that we could figure out how to do was sandwiches. And so it's a sandwich shop, but we brought all of our thoughts and ideas about food and cooking to the sandwich. So we kind of tried to sort of put everything between two slices of bread. So we really think of it as cooking as we had in any other restaurant, but just the bread is sort of the vehicle for delivering the meal. So yeah, I feel perfectly content calling it a sandwich shop and owning a sandwich shop and working in a sandwich shop, and it's been a lot of fun, and there's a lot you can do with it, it turns out. And
You have tons of interesting recipes. Do you do a lot of this fermenting in-house and so forth, too?
The fermenting we do off-site because fermenting and flour and yeast production, you know, making bread don't work so well together.
Oh, that's
in our place,
that.
Even though
that's
it seems
great.
Like they would be friends. But I think it has to do with just being really small, and the bread yeast and the fermentation sort of cross over in a way that doesn't work out very well.
Now, some of the terms you use are nautical, and you're like your Spanish Armada, which is sort of a tortilla.
Yeah.
And you had something with a dinghy in it, I saw, that was
in dinghy, yeah.
And then we have Henry Hudson. So you have a theme in names.
Yes. Well, that's the kind of nautical thing, I guess.
Captain
and it's one
Star.
Of those things, once you start, it's just so much fun, it's hard to stop. So I think part of it is the nautical thing, but then we also have Rebecca, who's from Liverpool, as you pointed out earlier, and she's just clever. She comes up with really clever names for things. So sometimes if we're a little stumped, we just give it to her to think about for a little while, and she can come up with a nice, funny title. And then there are things that just are of themselves interesting names, like Cockaleeky Soup, which is
it's
an English thing, actually a Scottish thing, that just has a great name because people from the UK aren't afraid of that sort of thing. And
I've spotted Dick, for God's sake.
Right. So I feel like there's kind of a little bit of Rebecca's good English sense of humor in the naming of things, and then also some nautical sensibility.
And you have salads, soups, and desserts as well.
Yeah, we have salads, soups, desserts, sandwiches, and then we have this whole egg bowl thing, which...
Yeah, what is that?
That kind of came out of making lunch for ourselves and just kind of preparing something and then just always adding an egg to it, and at some point it just... we started to notice a theme that maybe we should put this on the menu and add this to the offering at the restaurant. One, because it's good, but two, because it offers an alternative to the sandwich. It's nice to have kind of a brunchy, eggy something. It's kind of, to me, that egg dish is just like a one-pot meal that really is kind of a perfect way to eat. It's the way I really like to eat, just sort of a bowl of everything you kind of need for the day.
Yeah, I like that. And I guess the Spaniards have done this well with the tortillas and whatnot.
Right.
And there was another idea I had. There are a number of cultures that do well with that bowl concept, I think. All the noodle things and them.
Yeah, I think the whole one pot thing is a universal notion.
Interviewed somebody at one pot that was, what's his name?
Was it Ming Tsai?
Ming Tsai. He was big on one pots. You know Ming Tsai?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's big on that.
He did a whole one pot cookbook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You probably have your own favorites in here. What are some of these favorite recipes? Because if you describe it as you would food porn, listeners get really excited about getting a hold of the book.
Well, I think one of the recipes I really love in the book is a recipe for kedgeree, which is, again, an English dish. It's curried rice with smoked fish. We serve it with a little bit of yogurt sauce and a hard-boiled egg. And, again, it's kind of one of those one pots. Got rice, got some protein from the fish. We usually put a little herb, scallion, in there. And it's a very sustaining dish, but it's also delicious. And it's easy to make, but it's a little offbeat. I think that it's not common here, so I think it's a nice new way of preparing a fish and rice dish that Americans, anyway, might not be familiar with. It's pretty commonly seen, I think, on English menus, but not so much here.
Interestingly enough, it's actually typically a breakfast food.
It makes
a great breakfast, for sure.
I thought I'd sick eating it for breakfast in Scotland. I wasn't fond of it at all.
So I think that one's probably one of my favorite. I also really love the Cockaleeky, which is chicken leek and prune soup. Again, it doesn't seem completely like something that would sound delicious, but it's so delicious beyond the sum of its parts. It's one of those things that just becomes something else entirely. And it's still from Fergus Henderson. Really easy to make and just incredibly rewarding. And that one, people come here for that, for sure. There are people who come in, and we take it off the menu in the summer. We don't run any soups in the summer, and people will start right now, like, when's it coming back? When's it coming back? Do you have the Cockaleeky? Can you give me a date? So I really love those two dishes. And I think also the salad section is really strong. One of the things that I always have had a great affection for is salad in general, and we put a lot of energy into our salads here. We want them to be as exciting as a sandwich, and so I think the salad section is pretty strong. And
you have panzanella, which Peter loves.
Oh, yeah. I probably do eat that every day in tomato season. That's one of my personal all-time favorite things. That's a salty.
You have a good ribollita recipe, too.
Yeah, the ribollita's nice, too. True. You guys have found them all, I think. I think the ribollita's a favorite as well, definitely. And then, simple, but I love the fried rice dish as well. That's just something that I make for myself a lot, both at work and at home. I think that's just a good recipe that anybody who's interested in making themselves something at home but not wanting to make a fuss, it's just a great thing to
know how to make.
I can't resist asking you this, because you've been in on this whole development of Williamsburg and the Brooklyn. Everything, you and I were talking, I mean, is it just going to get to be more and more sort of a, what did we call it, a caricature? Of what
a parody.
A parody of what it's set out to be, or what's going to rescue it if it's going to do something else.
I don't know. I guess it could become legitimate, too. That's something we didn't think about. I don't know. I think there were simultaneously things happening. I think people like myself and the people I partnered with in Diner and Marlowe and Sons in the early days were interested in traditional classical restaurants. They wanted to be restaurant owners. I wanted to cook, sort of be a chef. So we were doing a very traditional thing in sort of a new location. And then a lot of that started happening in different neighborhoods in Brooklyn. People opening restaurants, the whole Smith Street thing in Carroll Gardens, Park Slope. Like, there were those places where this thing started to happen. And then at some point, somewhat related, and I think just related by the general population, there became this very big do-it-yourself movement, which has sort of defined Brooklyn in many ways. So I think that there are the people who own restaurants who are sort of restaurant professionals, and then there's this do-it-yourself movement of picklers and
fermenters,
sausage and makers and sausage. Beef jerky makers and candy makers and beverage makers that also coexist in Brooklyn. And that's the part that I think is a little, and then there's the food truck thing too, which is a big part of it. So I think that there is a lot of self-taught, self-motivated, do-it-yourself ethic in Brooklyn that will either become, will be things that turn into actual businesses. They rent a space and now their food truck is an actual shop that on whatever, Bedford Avenue or something, or the movement just moves into something else. So I think it's a little bit hard to tell right now because there are all of these outdoor markets, food markets, where there are a lot of people who are not classically or professionally trained doing it themselves. And we'll see. I think it's a little hard to call it right now as to which way it will go. But I think simultaneously there are people opening a lot more important restaurants in Brooklyn. And I wish I could think of the name of it, but somebody just in Williamsburg, and I keep meaning to go over there, opened an Italian restaurant, and they're actually a restaurant that exists in some part of Italy, and they opened a sister restaurant on Berry Street in Williamsburg, and I just read about it, and I was thinking.
Yeah, I read about it, and I can't remember who it is.
Yeah.
I know the original.
If you come up with it, could you... Could you send us a note about it?
It'll come through my head.
Will it come through your head?
Yeah.
Well,
good. That's pretty good. So when I read that, that was sort of remarkable.
Yeah, I was astounded, actually, when I read it.
Yeah, and even a couple of other people, again, terrible memory of mine, but the very famous guy who opened the Thai restaurant, this guy who has the place in Seattle who opened the Thai restaurant. And
he's in Portland. Puck in Portland.
Yeah, Puck. So I think that will start to happen, and that will be interesting because then Brooklyn kind of has to up its game a little bit. Not that we're not good, but when Brooklyn really becomes a less grassroots neighborhood or borough, it'll be interesting to see how the scene is transformed, and even by those people who, like myself, who might have gotten in early on the scene, how that affects all of us or any of us who've been working for a while.
Well, when we're getting ready to do our pilgrimage to Brooklyn, I will get in touch with you so you could be my guide.
We'll learn together.
let's hope you're still there, because your life's journey so far is one of the more interesting parts of the book. And,
well, I've been here for a long time. I'm waiting for my life's journey to maybe
I'm just wondering,
take me off Metropolitan Avenue.
I'm just wondering where you're going to go next, because you opened Salty because you were ready to do something different.
Yeah.
And you fulfilled the dream of doing something different very successfully, and it's recorded for posterity in the book. But I have a feeling that you might be making some more left and right turns in your future, and we'd certainly like you to keep in touch with us when you make those turns and you have a chance to talk to us about it. You don't have to write a book to come back on the program.
Well, that's so nice. I appreciate your confidence in my future, your prediction. I hope you're right.
I'm sure if it's a turn, it will be a turn for the better. And thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure to speak with the two of you.
Yeah. Ciao, Caroline.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back after this short break.
Podcasting services for On The Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next stop is actually one of our favorite restaurants in San Francisco, SPQR. And from the name, I guess you'll understand that it's Italian food and wine. And
presented in an extraordinarily unique fashion.
Oh yeah,
which I think we should just let our interviewees explain.
Right, but the interviewees are actually Matthew Acorino, who is a rising star chef, Kate Leahy, who is an inspired cookbook author and food writer.
And the owner of the establishment, Shelley Lindgren. Who's the wine director and was heavily involved in producing the book as well. She wasn't able to join us, but believe me, her work's represented in the book too. So you can eat and drink your way through some very unusual parts of Italy and have a whole lot of very unusual experiences. So I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing about it, and then you'll rush out and buy the book and go trotting over Italy just like Anne and Peter do, and we'll see you there.
What a delicious, absolutely inspiring book called SPQR, which, of course, is the restaurant. And we're going to be talking to Matthew Acorino, who is the executive chef, and the writer on this book, Kate Leahy, who has also written, you wrote A16, which we interviewed about too. It's another gorgeous book. But this now is subtitled Modern Italian Food and Wine, and it's not really a restaurant book. It's not just about SPQR. Who wants to explain the concept? Okay.
When we sat down to talk about writing a book, such an exciting thing to have this idea that we can sit down and chronicle all these recipes, but I thought, how could we do this in a way that was a little bit different? I didn't want it to be completely a coffee table cookbook, and I didn't want it to be something that was just a restaurant cookbook, and we didn't want it to be a pure travel cookbook, but we wanted it to be a blend of the three. So we organized it around the way the Roman roads are laid out and kind of let that guide us through regions or groupings of regions so that we could take inspiration from food, from winemakers, from travel there. We were able to travel quite a bit for the book and have some experiences and kind of chronicle those. And I was lucky enough to have both Kate and Shelley come with me, and that we were able to photographer along with us. And, you know, there are recipes in the book that were developed on the spot in Italy. There were wines that opportunities that we found to taste wine or try things or experience things that we could chronicle in the book.
Shelley Lindgren, who is the wine director of both A16 and SPQR, and is a co-owner of these restaurants as well. So there is quite a bit about wine. Could one of you give a sample of how the chapters are organized? You take a road.
What we did with the roads, Italy is divided up into so many different regions that we didn't want to just have region by region a kind of tour through Italy. We thought it would be more interesting to take people on a tour through the ancient Roman roads. And some of those roads went through multiple regions, and some went through one region. And that way we were able to tell the story of the wine. Oftentimes, if they were developed along the same road, they had a lot in common, even if they were in two different regions. And so we were able to explain the story about the wines and the history behind those wines. And that sort of fed into what we learned about maybe traditional foods, which inspired Matthew's more modern interpretations, very personal interpretations on things that we tasted there. So that was the basic premise for using ancient roads to sort of, organize the book. Because there's so many ways we could go, and this was a unique approach. We thought that could be a lot of fun.
Now, interestingly enough, and listeners, don't be confused here, these are not Roman roads where you're plodding along like the legionnaires of the Roman army. These were traditional routes. They tended to be straight-line roads, and today there are roads in their place. There are roads, cars on them,
okay.
In their place.
You really had to explain that.
Right. It is funny. We were, Shelley, Matthew, and I, we were caravanning through, I think it was from Lazio. We left Rome, and we were driving north to Tuscany, and sure enough, we were driving along via Aurelia. Right now it's the S-161 or something. But it really, we did see the signs via Aurelia, and we stopped by, and I think he took a picture of one of them. It was just, it really did sort of, I guess it kind of helped justify ordering the book along these roads and kind of linking it to the Italian peninsula. It's such a complex place in European history that this was just a window. It's not Italy's entire history, of course, but it's a window into what makes that country so fascinating.
The interesting thing to know was emphasizing this is that, in fact, if listeners had a mind to, they could drive the road you drove. The thing
that they should bear in mind is that this is now often the slowest way to get from point A to point B rather than the fastest, because the outer strata road network totally bypasses these old routes along the way. But I want to tell a quick story here, because, and Anne's probably forgotten about this, but the first time we were in Italy, we were in Rome for 4 days, and that we were brave, we rented a car, and we were going to drive, and our next stop was going to be Assisi. And Assisi was real easy from Rome, because it's straight up the Via Flaminia. So I thought, well, this is easy. So I found where the Via Flaminia was on the map, and I got our car, and I picked up Anne at the hotel, and we started to drive towards the Via Flaminia. I got to a point where I touched the Via Flaminia, and it was a one-way street. so much for my driving navigating
right.
in Italy.
This was your first time in Italy, yeah.
I did get better as time went on.
Well, what I was trying to get at in these chapters is that you get a lot of information in. You get a sense of the place for each of these regions, people there that you've met or knew. You talk about the wine, and then you do recipes. All of that comes together as a piece for each of these roads, right?
Correct, yeah.
Talking to Matthew, we know that this recipes, even if some were developed right along while you were traveling, they're frequently modernized and made and personalized to his style. Could you give us some examples of some of those recipes, Matthew? I mean, what about rye gnocchi? Is that rye gnocchi with Savoy cabbage, potatoes, and crispy speck authentic or modified?
Right, and that's something that gnocchi technique is sort of based on the pâte à choux dough, which is a very sort of French thing to make these gnocchi. And I actually learned that technique working for Thomas Keller here in the United States. But traveling through that region and eating all the speck and being able to stop and stop by small alpine towns and have speck and all the cheeses and having so much of the rye bread. We had rye pasta and having rye berries cooked for us. And so those things became evocative to me of that region. And so I wanted to incorporate my own personal spin on that and kind of brought that dish together to represent that. So that's just one of the ways in the book that sort of my personal, I have fused my personal style or something that makes me who I am along with something we felt was evocative of the region. Another example of that is earlier in my career worked at a restaurant called Antonella Colonna in Lazio.
Yeah, you
it was
said
actually
that.
The town.
Yeah.
Yeah. Town called Labico. One of his specialties was the abbacchio, the baby lamb. And there were times where we did it whole roasted, and there were times where we did it broken into smaller roasts. But it was something that was always generally presented tableside and carved tableside, and was one of the first experiences I ever had having to trot out into the dining room and cut something in front of customers. And it's very emblematic in my mind of the early part of my career. And it's very emblematic of that region, that roasted, spit-roasted baby lamb is something I always think of when I think of Rome and Lazio. So we did a lamb recipe in the book, but it's broken into five different parts, and there are definitely some modern techniques, and we tried to flesh those out and give good direction to the reader as to how we were using those so that it seemed somewhat approachable, but it's certainly in a more restaurant, modern kind of style, my version of that lamb that I remember from way back when.
Now, I mean, you frequent Italy because you have extended family in Apulia.
Right.
Yeah. And tell me this, what reactions did you get? I bet you everybody loved sharing their recipes and welcoming you into their region.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many people we were able to work with who cooked with grandmas. I cooked with chefs at wineries there. I cooked with so many different people before we wrote this book and in the process of writing this book, and people who are able to see what we're doing with the book and have seen it already. I mean, it's already come out now. We've already gotten feedback from people that have their hands on the book because they ordered it and had it shipped there. So people are just excited about it. They're excited to see the interpretation and really open to, I guess, my ideas about what I think Italian food or my interpretation of Italian food.
What's kind of funny about that, so that idea of using these sort of very personal and modern interpretations of Italian flavors is that you still, when you walk into an Italian kitchen, they don't care if you're Matthew Acquolino and you have all these great ideas. They're going to tell you how they do it, and they have no pretense about it. It's sort of, see, Matthew, when we were working in the Marche, it was kind of like, well, this is how we're going to do this pasta, and you might have a great technique, but I'm the grandmother. I know what I'm doing. So it was just kind of nice to see people who are just very sure of themselves, that you can learn from them.
you don't actually have to do it exactly how they do it, but by doing it the way they do it and learning how they do it, you get a base of understanding about those flavors and the history behind them.
You and I talked about these sort of underappreciated regions. What goes to the top of your list from this book in terms of a major region discovery that when where most tourists don't even bother to pursue?
I almost hesitate to say it because I don't want to send more people there because I like it the way that it is. But I would say La Marca is probably one of my favorite regions in Italy because it is just absolutely not touristy and sort of, and as is Friuli.
Yeah, Friuli.
And the food in
fun.
Both of the regions is really great, really, really amazing. There's a lot of amazing restaurants, very vibrant food culture, just amazing wines. I'm a person who likes to drink white wine, and there's a lot of great white wines from both of those regions.
Well, there's also a wonderful red wine. I noticed it was mentioned in the text, Lacrima di Monte Alba.
Correct, yeah.
I remember drinking that when we were in La Marca, and I said, it was quite delicious wine. And and one of those wines that probably never gets outside of Italy very much.
It barely, I mean, I think only maybe just 5 years ago was the first time a San Francisco restaurant was able to import it and serve it in the restaurant, and Shelley Lindgren was very involved with getting Lacrima di Mora de Alba represented in the San Francisco restaurant scene.
The Fluke Crudo recipe, is that authentic or modified with sausage, stuffed olives, and citrus? It's beautiful, too, by the way.
There's a town, Ascoli Piceno, where they have
We've been there.
That's right. This is their local specialty, right?
That's right. And so it's you basically can't go and have a glass of wine without being offered those sausage-stuffed olives in that town.
Right, I remember
that. I forgot about those. Yeah. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, and so for me, and that became a flavor memory for me of traveling through La Marca, traveling through that region. And so the other big memory for me in that region was the seafood. I mean, when we were along the coast in Senegalia and a couple of the other towns there, I mean, we would go to the fish market at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's the most amazing fish you've ever seen in your life. And here they are, you're right at the fish auction, and it's the octopus and all of these little fish, mantis, shrimp. It was amazing. So I kind of, those are my memories, seafood, and these olives, and I sort of put them together into that one dish, which is just another example in the book of where we were trying to take the experiences that I had and my own personal intuition about cooking to put something together. And that's a dish that we've served here at SBQR, and it's gotten great feedback from our customers on it, and something that's come and gone on the menu. And there are definitely some dishes throughout the book that are representative of things that we've done in the restaurant.
Yeah, no, I can't help but mention this. Moreno Cedroni.
Yeah, exactly. And he's the father, you know, to me, someone who I look to for. He's the person that does a lot of not just crudo, but also fish in the salumi style, you know, cured and smoked and marinated fish, and has multiple restaurants in that region doing that. And I definitely, he's a friend and someone that I look to for counsel in developing the book.
Yeah, he comes out of El Bulli.
We stayed in the little town where the restaurant Symposium is called. Is it Pompili, Lucia Pompili? Is he the chef there? He's a very well-known chef, and his restaurant is, Quattro Stagioni.
Quattro Stagioni. Also has a wedding chapel.
I'm reliving this whole thing.
What fun.
Hold on. Let me just tell this story, and then we'll ask them if they had a similar experience before we sign off. I'm sure you must have had a mad experience like this. So we had a reservation made by the people whose place we were staying at in this little town. It begins with a C. I've forgotten the name of it now. And it's dark. We drove up to the restaurant where we thought the restaurant was, and there were no lights on in the restaurant. And it was really peculiar. We thought perhaps we had missed the entrance, and we kept on driving back and forth up and down the road. And then at one point we overshot, and we drove into somebody's driveway. And their lights were on, and they were very civilized. They said, I said, is that where the restaurant is? They said, yes, that's there. He must be closed. And we said, how can he possibly be closed? We're supposed to have a reservation. It turned out that we weren't able to reach him until we were actually at Cedroni's restaurant a few days later, and we found out that his daughter was a contestant in Miss Teen Italia. And she was still in the competition, so he just decided to stay over. He didn't tell anybody.
Yeah,
he didn't tell anybody. The restaurant was just closed. He wasn't there, so it was closed.
Well, you know, there are 1,000 stories like that, and there are 1,000 stories in this book. It's so packed with information, I don't know how we can possibly cover it, except to recommend that people actually go out and buy this, and which they should. I mean, this is a keeper, too, for us. And it's Modern Italian Food and Wine, SPQR, which means?
And it is populus quae Romanus.
Right.
For the set-in people of Rome.
Exactly.
Well, so. Well done. You're up on your Italian history. I'm glad to hear that, Matt.
Well, next time we're in San Fran, we're going to have to come back because it sounds like it's very different from our last experience at SPQR. Sounds like you've expanded. You've packed the menu with more options. The wine list. Everything's different. And you, of course.
Yes. Oh, we'll welcome you with open arms and look forward to seeing you.
Great. Thank you for talking to us. And Kate, thank you, too. Are you working on any other books?
Right now I'm figuring out what the next step is.
Oh, all right. never time to relax once you've published.
Exactly.
Well, let us know what it is when you do it. And thank you for a wonderful cookbook.
Thank you so much for attention. Yeah.
And we'll be back with our final segment in today's program after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Skirt Steak sure is a pretty clever sounding title for a book. And it caused me to open it and look very quickly when we received it. I thought it was going to be a fascinating story. Then I saw there were 229 footnotes, and I began to have second thoughts.
They're very hilarious.
But Charlotte Druckman wrote
a great sense of style on him.
She did a tremendous piece of work. It's a fascinating story. Stay with this one all the way to the end, because it really is a landmark achievement, don't you think?
I do.
And I can hardly wait for the second book, which will have 429 footnotes. Here's Charlotte.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to talking to Charlotte Druckman, because I guess I've been following you on Twitter for such a long time. And I was trying to remember that I was blown away by one of your pieces, which you can't remember and I can't remember. But anyhow, you now have a book out called Skirt Steak, which is a really ingenious title, subtitled Women Chefs on Standing the Heat and Staying in the Kitchen. Now, when I picked up this book, Charlotte, I thought immediately that I thought of Ann Cooper's book, A Woman's Place is in the Kitchen.
Yes.
But it's not. It's a totally different book.
It is totally different, and I had seen Ann Cooper's book when I was first thinking I wanted to write my book. And since Ann's book already existed, that was one reason to go in a very different direction. But I also thought that Ann's book was very much of its time. It's very much a survey where you have a lot of statistics and data, and it's a much more impersonal book. And I wanted it to be a personal book, and when I say personal, I don't mean about me personally, but I wanted you to feel as though you were having conversations like I had with all of the chefs in the book. So I describe it as communal memoir, which I don't know if such a thing exists, but that's what I was going for. And that way you almost have these bookends. You can go back to Anne's book and look at what she was talking about. And I think she wrote that in the early 90s. Or
it could have been, early 90s, I think. Because we were all in that stage where we founded the Women Chefs and Restaurateurs.
Yes.
And that was going strong at the time.
Yes, and I think a lot has changed. And I don't mean just in terms of numbers and behavior and the life of a chef, but I think a lot has changed just in terms of the field of food writing or culinary literature. And I also feel that we have had all of these books. Think Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential was such a watershed moment when that book was published, but it also set this tone for a certain type of narrative and a certain style, which I think tends to be quite male. We expect more male chefs to sort of have that brash tone and that sort of modern-day swashbuckling kind of rebel. I love his writing, don't get me wrong, I absolutely love it, but I just thought we don't really have anything that allows itself to have that kind of honesty for women chefs, except, of course, and the book came out while I was already writing my book, Gabrielle Hamilton's memoir, which I absolutely love. But I wanted to have something where you heard from a lot of different women chefs about what they do for a living, and in a way that they weren't being quarantined, if you will, for being different or being an exception to the rule. So that was what dictated how I wrote the book.
Now tell me, how you selected the chefs.
Well, I wish, and I say this and I mean it, I wish that I had had a lot more time and money comb the entire country and pick some less obvious locales to find the women. But I started with major cities where I knew there were deep pockets of women chefs. Now I sound like binders full of women, but you know what I mean. There's certain areas. The California Bay Area has so many women chefs, and I have spent most of my life in New York City, and of course, when I say lots of, there's always going to be some kind of relativity there because you still find more men than women, but in cities like New York, you'll find a lot more women than you might elsewhere. Chicago's another good example. Boston, wow. There are so many talented, accomplished women chefs in Boston. I sometimes think people forget this. So I started with the more obvious, if you will, cities. And then I also went with chefs that I admired as an eater or just had, you know, heard about and seen in other places and had a sense that they would have something to say or had a sense that they'd had the kind of career that would have given them a lot of experience to draw on. But then, which was really great, I also started taking suggestions from other friends of mine and food writers. And the best part was when the chefs themselves would then say, oh, you need to go talk to my friend, mm-hmm, whoever, yeah, or you might not know about this woman, and she's opening her own restaurant this year, and you really need to talk to her. And that was the best.
Now tell me this. How different did this book end up, and how different did your perspective end up when you started?
I guess that the major difference is, first of all, I did not expect, I didn't expect to find as many women chefs as I did, and I realized I could have kept going, but then I would never have been able to write the book.
Right.
So there are definitely more of them in it. I also didn't realize how many would say yes. So in my mind, I thought I was going to have this core group of 40 women, and I would really concentrate on them, and I thought that would be enough of a challenge in itself to get 40 characters into a book where you could feel like you'd gotten to know them. And then when everyone started saying yes, I wasn't about to say no, especially if you're me, and I guess this is selfish, as a journalist, you're so excited to be able to have these conversations. I mean, these are great opportunities.
Yeah, you said that, yes.
So I just said, okay, I'll do it. And then I ended up talking to 73 women, and I could have kept going, but that was when I realized I needed to write the book. So that, in that sense, it was different than I thought. But then also, I had this very long list of topics that I thought I might want to talk about. And I had to write them out when I wrote my proposal because, of course, you have to give a proposed table of contents. But after I started speaking to the chefs, I stopped looking at that list, and I decided instead to listen to the topics that they wanted to talk about or the ideas that came up the most, and then I rewrote the table of contents based on that. And I wouldn't say that I added any topics, but I just took a lot of them out and consolidated them.
Now, what were some of the things that you found the most surprising? You just mentioned, really, you had some preconceptions going in as to what you might find.
Yes.
Because you'd already written on the same subject in a much shorter form in Gastronomica. So what were some of the things that you found that you didn't expect?
I didn't expect. People always say that chefs aren't the most talkative or that they can be really tight-lipped about things. And I had the complete opposite experience. So I, not only was I not expecting to have these really long, wonderful conversations, but the candor was, it sounds very corny when I say that I am so grateful for it, but the women couldn't have been more just open about their lives, but also their thoughts about topics that I think sometimes you assume in a profession that people might be afraid to talk about. They might be afraid to talk about how they feel about the media, especially when they're speaking to a journalist, or how they feel about awards, when they can also admit that those awards are what helped their careers. I didn't know how forthcoming they would be about motherhood, which I think can be the slipperiest topic when you're doing a book like this, because none of us, me mostly, and I was leading the conversation, none of us wanted to write that typical sort of women's book where it was about a lot of complaining about sexual harassment or talking about how we cook differently because we put so much love into it, or, oh, isn't it so hard because we also have to balance families and be mothers. And so I think that becomes one of the more dangerous topics because you don't want to fall into that trap.
Right.
And so their willingness to talk about all of those things with so much honesty and often, too, so much ambivalence was really unexpected and probably the greatest gift.
And a lot of these women, actually, that we've interviewed, and you seem to have gravitated to the more outspoken ones anyhow, such as Amanda Cohen.
Yes, oh my God. I just love the way that she sees things.
Yes. So why don't you tell our listeners what she said?
Well, Amanda, it's funny because as a journalist, you tend not to befriend the people that you're writing about, or else then you can't write about them anymore, mm-hmm. right? So sadly for me, I probably can't write about Amanda anymore because we've really become such good friends, but it's because we joke that we're honorary sisters. Her way of seeing the world is so smart, first of all, but then it's also in this way that only she could see it. And maybe some of that has to do with the fact that she's chosen to take paths in her career that are not the obvious paths, chose to focus on what she would call vegetable cookery.
Yeah, dirt candy.
Yes, and she's very clear not to say vegetarian cooking
right.
because there's such a stigma attached to vegetarian cooking, which is that it's healthy, sort of has these self-righteous overtones. You're maybe going to find a lot of hippies hanging out. Her restaurant is really just about celebrating food that happens to be vegetarian.
She told us, she said, my restaurant is a vegetable restaurant. It's not it's not a vegetarian restaurant.
No, she has this just visionary sense of, I think, of whimsy, but then she's also so good at just seeing things for how they are, maybe because in a way she feels like an outsider. So she was very good at talking about how she feels the media portrays women chefs or how the Beard Awards work, because as someone who has decided to focus on vegetables, she has already taken herself out of what most would consider the equations for getting proper media coverage or for getting awards.
Well,
so,
no, that wasn't true, though. The male chef in San Francisco who did the vegetarian.
Jeremy Fox.
Yeah.
Yes, true. And true, but you know, the thing about that,
he was a guy.
He also wasn't vegetarian. But
no, wasn't vegetarian, but also he had the backing, and he had the background in his career of having worked in fine dining and having had that training that if he had chosen vegetables way early on, probably wouldn't have happened for him. And he opened a restaurant that was considered a much more sort of upscale statement, whereas Amanda chose to do something really small and in the East Village. And these are not the kinds of restaurants, unless you're going really high-end, like a Momofuku Ko, for example.
Yeah.
The kind of restaurant Amanda opened isn't the kind of restaurant that's going to get the same amount of attention or be given the same type of culinary credibility as what Jeremy Fox did. So it's not just a vegetable thing there.
Change the subject just a little bit, and I haven't read as much of the book as Anne has, so maybe I'm off base, maybe I'm not. But I noticed one of the chefs that's included is Allison Vines Rushing?
Yeah.
From Mila in New Orleans. Now, she's an interesting subset of the women chefs because her husband is a chef involved in the same restaurant.
Yes.
And that in and of itself is a category that's not small.
No.
A lot of people get into it together.
What I thought the book would be and then what the book was, I had wanted to do a whole chapter just on working with your spouse or your significant other, because I think that's a whole fascinating topic, and it ended up being easier to trim it a little bit and umbrella it into the section of having your own business. But Allison, funnily enough, when we talked about working with your spouse, had less to say about the business side, and for her, it was more about what kind of attention they got, because she's one of the very few women to ever win a Rising Star Beard Award, which she did at such a young age, and she was working for Alan Ducasse at the time.
Did she also get a food and wine? Did she do a food and wine? Wasn't she?
That's
something to look at. That cover. I don't know how they have the nerve to put that group on the cover of Food and Wine's Best New Chefs every year. And it'd be so obvious, the most women they've ever had, the whole group, at one time was two.
I think it's possible that one year they might have had three, but it was because they nominated husband and wife teams.
Okay.
So they had more than 10 chefs.
This year was one, I think.
Yeah.
It's so embarrassing. Why did they do that?
Well, this goes back to the whole premise of the book, which is that I worked at Food and Wine, and I can say for having, I didn't work on that, on the Best New Chefs, but I can say for having worked there that you're dealing with a really intelligent group of women who care so much about the food world and so much about chefs, and they are certainly not sexist. I think the problem is the criteria that have been set up for those awards, and you can say the same thing about the Beards, is that they end up favoring a very specific type of restaurant experience, but also a very specific type of resume. And I think that they're trying to work on that, but it's slow in coming. So what happens is, in their mind, they know that there are all of these talented chefs out there, male or female, but when it comes down to making sure they're fitting all the check boxes on their list, they end up often with something that does not look like a female chef.
Yeah, Michelin could be accused, and is accused, and probably rightly so, of the same thing. I think there are now 5 women in Europe who have 3 Michelin stars, and one of them isn't really a chef. So that's only 4, and the fourth one only appeared in the last 2 years, and it was because her father had 3 stars before that, and
yeah.
soon as she took over, they took one of those away. But I wanted to just reference one more thing, and it will either encourage or discourage people from reading the book. It certainly shouldn't discourage them from buying the book, which is really a blended exercise in writing. But 291 footnotes. I think you're in league with my optometrist, who would like to sell me 6 new pairs of glasses every year.
What you don't know is that your optometrist paid me on the sly.
I'm sure.
Optometry Association of America paid me because they want to get more people coming in for eye exams.
Yeah.
No, the footnotes are in there because when I started writing, I realized that there were certain facts and figures that were going to have to be footnoted, but that everybody hates footnotes, me included. I don't like reading them. I don't like writing them, so that maybe if I started making the footnotes a little bit funny, or I just started having some fun with the footnotes, that I could then help readers have a better time with the book. Certainly, it helped me have a better time writing the footnotes, but I did that deliberately to make it more approachable. And you could go through the whole book and never read the footnotes. That would be okay, but I actually think the footnotes are probably the funniest part of the book.
I do, too. And I also think that's the biggest part of you're exposing your own personality and ideas.
Yeah, and I always say, and it's true, they became a repository for my punchiness. So when I was getting annoyed or frustrated, they would show in the footnotes.
Exactly.
I have a final thought for you. It's actually a little bit of homework for you, if you're interested.
Okay.
Because we had the most fascinating experience, it was now probably about 7 or 8 years ago. We interviewed a wonderful lady chef called Carmen Ruscalleda.
Yes.
Who has a restaurant in just outside Barcelona. She's in business with her husband, who is front of house, but she's clearly in charge. There's no question about that. And she was the first person we ever allowed to speak their answers to our students in their native language and get a translation afterwards, because it was clear that Carme had a lot to say, and she had an enormous amount to say about how difficult it was to develop as a chef and progress as a chef in Spain. Well, I think in Europe generally. So the people here in the United States think they have a tough time. they should try it in France and Spain and Italy and find out what it's really like.
Not Italy, actually.
But if you're interested, you can find the interview that we did with her with a translation, findable through our website. I think you would find it interesting, and maybe you'll even do a supplement to your book that says something like, "And you thought you had a tough time of it."
Oh, God. Well, I will read. I will go and read it because I would love to.
Yeah,
no, you have to listen to it. You have to listen to it.
Well, anyhow, to summarize this, I think you get the people that you have in your book are just so fascinating. We've interviewed so many of them, and I just got really wrapped up in the characters, and I think that you're not altogether correct when you say that it's more about them than about you. There's a lot of you in this book, Charlotte.
That's because the publishing side always says that you have to put more of yourself in. But that's another conversation for another.
I think Anne's
going to probably ask me to cut this out. But
yeah,
I, and I'll edit it out of the interview if I have to, but I just can't avoid saying that the characters you interview, the ladies you interview, they have two B's, or actually four B's. They have breasts, but they also have balls.
Yes. Yes.
And I think if you wanted to advise somebody who was a woman going into the kitchen who wanted to become a chef and own a restaurant, you'd have to say, get big ones made of brass.
Whereas I think it's Michelle Bernstein's the one who says you need cojones.
Oh, she's brilliant.
That's it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Charlotte, for joining us
and
today.
She's set drugs.
Yes. Drugs. I am set drugs on Twitter. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Charlotte. Talk to you again.
Okay, I hope so.
Tweet me.
Bye.
Bye.
And who knows, gentlemen, we might have some more guys next week. But in the meantime, we hope you'll join us again. Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.